From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Lofty new rhetoric for a familiar message. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. The president, who's picked so many fights with so many people, told Congress last night it's time for a change.
The time for trivial fights is behind us.
Even some never-Trump holdouts were impressed, but the bar was low for supporters who only hoped their president would act presidential. The consensus is that he did, but without explaining how ambitious plans can be paid for or how to resolve conflicts with his own party in Congress. Has teleprompter Trump replaced Twitter Trump for the long term or just for a one-night stand? On our talking point later, Snapchat and billions in expected investments for disappearing messages. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. A platform based on disappearing messages may be worth billions of dollars. Tomorrow, the parent company of Snapchat makes its initial public offering. That's our talking point at the end of this program. But first, this news update. President Trump may have had a familiar message last night in his first address to a joint meeting of Congress, but his tone and his delivery were something new.
Everything that is broken in our country can be fixed. Every problem can be solved. And every hurting family can find healing and hope. Our citizens deserve this and so much more. So why not join forces and finally get the job done and get it done right?
Julie Bykowitz is a White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of people have commented that the first address to Congress by this president sounded a lot like other presidents' addresses to Congress. Why is that so important?
Well, it's actually what makes it newsworthy in a way. We have not, to this point, had a President Trump that has done anything by the books or in a conventional manner. And so there was a lot of anticipation going into last night, you know, as to how exactly this new president would interact with his party leaders and Democrats in the halls of Congress. It's usually a very sort of sedate setting. It's certainly not like his very famous rallies that he holds. There's not really a natural sort of raucous cheering section. And I think the news out of it is he played to that audience just as any other president would have done.
No raucous cheering session, but a lot of Republicans giving him standing ovations. And, of course, he loves standing ovations and has been known to count them.
Perhaps
he counted those last night.
If you notice from last night, he was really looking mostly at the Republican half of the room. It was as if he, you know, enjoyed seeing their reaction and was kind of blocking out, in a way, the Democrats on the other side of the room who were, you know, certainly not standing for many of his applause lines. And, you know, some people were even sort of giving him the thumbs down and doing other gestures during the speech. So he trained his eyes on the half of the audience that was very enjoying what he had to say.
So I understand Republican leaders are at the White House today, but let's first hear a little bit from the Democrats. Chuck Schumer, of course, from New York, who is the minority leader in the U.S. Senate. Here's what he said.
You know, this president's speech matter a lot less than the speeches of just about any other president because they're detached from his reality. He talks one way and does another.
Julie Bykowitz, back to you. How are the Democrats hoping to make that case?
Well, you know, in some ways, even though it's a partisan thing for them to say, of course, there's a little bit of evidence to that, which is that the president tends to respond differently in different settings, really enjoys and sort of thrives in playing to his audience. That's why even on a day where he had this very well-received speech earlier in the day, you know, he was talking a little bit differently to different groups of people. And so I think that the Democrats are hoping that he will continue that sort of pattern where they can just very easily pick out ways that he's taking actions that are quite different than what he's saying, you know, to audiences like that.
What did he say earlier in the day before he got to this speech, which really didn't contain a lot of new information, but as you say, was newsworthy mainly for its tone and the way he delivered it?
Well, of course, some of the remarks coming out of the White House yesterday, you sort of saw him in some ways seeming to call into question the Jewish gravesite desecrations that have been going on and the bomb threats being called into Jewish community centers, talking about, you know, maybe that there was something going on there with it not necessarily being people who are anti-Semitic, but in a way people who are trying to set that up and make it look a certain way. And that was 100% not the tone he was taking during the speech later in the day. He very, you know, opened with a very sort of clear and unifying call on that topic. So I think that's just one of the ways that, you know, to sort of say this is what Chuck Schumer is trying to point out, and certainly we're hearing that from other Democrats as well, that what the president says in a speech doesn't necessarily match other things that other messages that he's giving out to different audiences.
Marco Rubio apparently said that it was a very presidential speech, important critic of the president, of course, who challenged him during the campaign. And looking presidential, being presidential, appearing presidential, that seems to be good enough at the moment for the Republicans.
They're definitely enjoying this day of nice, traditional media coverage, glowing reviews in a way of the president's speech, and so is the White House. In fact, the White House decided to postpone what was supposed to be an executive order ceremony today, where we would have a new version of the travel ban. So we've got a couple of details on that out, but it was supposed to be on deck for today, and the White House has chosen to just keep the main news story of the day being the speech last night. We are certainly hearing from all sorts of Republicans, rave reviews and many things matching what Marco Rubio said, just that it was very sort of leaderly and presidential, okay, and something people have waited for quite a while.
And yet there were many things in it that Republicans don't agree with. We'll talk more about that as we go along. Julie Bakowitz at the White House for the Associated Press, many thanks.
Thank you.
In a moment, the rhetoric was loftier, but the message was still the same. On To the Point from Public Radio International.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To the Point. Donald Trump may get over his dispute with CNN, which reports today that 7 in 10 of the people who watched last night's address to Congress feel more optimistic about the country's direction. Again, that's just among those who watched and presumably who watched on CNN. Walter Shapiro is a columnist for Roll Call. He's a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and he's a lecturer on presidential politics in the news media at Yale. Always good to hear from you.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
You have written this morning that this was the most perplexing speech of Donald Trump's career. What was perplexing about it?
Well, first of all, in what storeroom at Mar-a-Lago was this fellow, the fellow impersonating the 45th president, been hiding? Because this is a totally different Donald Trump than we have seen at any point in either the campaign or certainly not during the dystopian inaugural address. So that is one thing that's puzzling. The other thing that was puzzling, perplexing, is the degree to which Donald Trump, with the cheers of Republicans, has abandoned one of the core principles of the Republican Party, balanced budgets and being obsessed with the national debt. Trump last night devoted exactly one sentence to the national debt that is now approaching $20 trillion. I went back and checked 1981, Ronald Reagan's comparable speech to Congress, a month after taking office, the dominant image was that America had a $1 trillion national debt. And Reagan furrowed his brow and asked, how am I going to make that real to you? Well, it is a stack of $1,000 bills 67 miles high. Right now, the stack of $1,000 bills would be over 1,300 miles high. And the point is that the Republicans don't seem to mind. And while one could overstate the importance of green eyeshade arithmetic, this is supposedly a founding principle of the Republican Party, and it was totally jettisoned last night when it was Trump came across as a shop-until-you-drop president.
Shop-till-you-drop, meaning, in other words, that he proposed a lot of programs but didn't indicate how they would be paid for. On the other hand, we've heard all this positive response from the Republicans, or heard about it. The Dow went over 21,000 points today for the first time. So maybe this change of image is something that will be good for this president.
Well, it may be good for the president, but two things come to mind. Number one, unlike any other president we have had, Donald Trump can change the mood in Washington in an instant with an intemperate midnight or 5 a.m. tweet based on something he saw on Fox and Friends. Number two, and this is harder to measure, because Trump has been so omnipresent, so in your face, if you will, during his 6 weeks as president, that it is really hard for one event to totally change perceptions of Donald Trump, President of the United States. It is a point on a grid, but there are so many other points that it may not have as much impact as a similar speech by a more, if you will, reticent president, a Ronald Reagan, if you will, had back in 1981.
Walter Shapiro, again, at Roll Call, NYU's law school, the Yale as well, a longtime observer of presidential politics. Let's take a look at one of the things that he said today, or excuse me, one of the things he said last night with respect to immigration. Here it is.
Switching away from this current system of lower-skilled immigration and instead adopting a merit-based system, we will have so many more benefits. It will save countless dollars, raise workers' wages, and help struggling families, including immigrant families, enter the middle class. I believe that real and positive immigration reform is possible as long as we focus on the following goals: to improve jobs and wages for Americans, to strengthen our nation's security, and to restore respect for our laws.
Mickey Kaus is a political commentator. He's author of the book The End of Equality, and he blogs at Kaus Files. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks, Warren.
Yesterday, as we heard briefly earlier in the program, Mr. Trump said something about immigration, which was that there might be a path for citizenship for the so-called Dreamers, the kids who were brought here as very young people who are still not citizens. He didn't say that last night. He said something else. But what do you think? You've been supportive of him in the immigration area. Were you worried after he said that with regard to the Dreamers?
Oh, I was certainly worried. He went beyond that. He implied that there was a bigger deal even for people who aren't Dreamers, who are here illegally, not for citizenship, but for legalization. You're always worried with him. It's a little like Newt Gingrich in the welfare debate. People who are, you know, egomaniacal political leaders, they walk into a room and think they're the man who is going to cut the deal. And Gingrich was always doing that and giving away the store, and he had to be restrained by his more temperate aides. Trump is very similar, but we did get welfare reform in the long run, and we might get immigration reform in the long run with Trump. But there's always the danger that he will walk into the room, talk to some executives, news anchors who are obsessed with some form of amnesty, and say, sure, we can have an amnesty. So it was troubling, but thankfully he pulled it back for the speech, and It was the same old Trump in the speech.
It was news anchors, of course, that he spoke to yesterday, yeah, including a couple of them from CNN. Once again, he's been they got excluded from something recently because he didn't like what was reported on CNN. Well, what do you think he means by positive immigration reform and merit-based immigration reform?
Well, there's a lot, you know, two-thirds of the million or so immigrants every year are family reunion. In other words, not just the wives and children of people who are here, but also their brothers and sort of more distant family relations. And there's, for a long time, there's been a push to cut back on that and instead do what Canada and Australia do, which is admit the people with skills who are not going to compete with people at the bottom of the ladder. They're not unskilled workers sort of pushing down wages, but they're, you know, high-tech people in theory. And he embraced that, and that's sort of a halfway compromise between between the open borders position and the let's cut back all illegals position. It happens to appeal to business and Republicans. So it is the basis for a compromise. I'm not sure it's a great compromise because it drives down the wages of American engineers. And also this whole emphasis on merit, merit this, merit that, I'm not sure that sits very well with Americans. But I think that's what it was about.
How do you think the speech went? How do you think it? How do you, as a person who may be somewhat dubious about Trump, but very supportive of his what he said in the past, at least about immigration? How do you feel about the impressions that he gave last night?
I thought it was a huge win for him because it went against the whole expectations that had been created in the media, which is either he was a budding fascist authoritarian or he was incompetent or both. He did not seem like a fascist. He did not seem incompetent. He seemed very traditional, and his facts were in order, and he obviously has a competent speech-writing staff, so that was reassuring. So I thought, it's what Peggy Noonan has always said. It's sane Trump shows up on the scene. His policies are actually quite popular once you get rid of the sort of overlaying layer of seeming unpredictability.
Mickey Kaus again, author of The End of Equality, a blogger at Kaus Files. One of the memorable moments last night was when Donald Trump allowed the applause to go on for so long when he memorialized Ryan Owen. He's the Navy SEAL that was killed in Yemen. The president's taken a lot of heat for that death and for that incident, the first to be ordered during his presidency. Ryan Owen's wife, Karen, was sitting next to Ivanka Trump, and the president really let the applause go on.
And Ryan is looking down right now, you know that, and he's very happy because I think he just broke a record.
Broke a record for the applause and the length of the standing ovation. And the widow's name was Karen, and she was next to Ivanka Trump, Mr. Trump's daughter. Samuel Popkin is with us. He's a professor of political science at the University of California at San Diego. He was a consultant to five Democratic presidential campaigns. He's author of a forthcoming book, The Republican Crackup and the Future of Presidential Politics. Good to have you with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here with Professor Shapiro. I didn't know Walter was a professor. Now.
Well, he's at Yale. I don't know if they call him
a professor.
They call him a lecturer. So
that's good enough.
All right. So you can both be called professor. In any case, do you agree with Mickey Kaus that this was a big win, particularly what he was able to do with that particular moment and the whole issue of the Navy SEALs and the attack in Yemen?
Well, I thought that was one of the very most effective of moments of the speech. The speech as a whole bought him a lot of time and kept him in control in the same really authoritarian manner he likes, and he got himself way out of two dead ends and hooked the Democrats. He really solved his Yemen problem after trying to blame it all on the generals and Obama by getting the wife there, and nobody's going to be able to really shout at him about it with that memory in everybody's face.
Even though the father has been very critical of President Trump.
Fine. So there's a divided family. If I were Donald Trump's pollsters, which I never hope to be or expect to be, thank God, they would definitely be thrilled because it's going to be very hard. And I think the Republicans gave him such a big ovation because they were so thrilled to get it off the table. And he also he's going to hook the Democrats into a very big bargaining situation by saying we need some amnesty. And the question is going to be how much and where and what kind. And within the Republicans, there's going to be this debate because you forget how many states Republican farmers desperately need agricultural workers that they can't get anybody else. And the other places where people want the high tech people that aren't being produced here. And I think that was very effective. It reminds me of the Stockholm syndrome. When you're a captive of somebody, and we are captive because he is president, the random behavior of good and bad keeps you worrying. Maybe there'll be a pivot. Maybe there won't. What's he going to do next? So he's really kept us all on the hook very effectively with this one-hour pivot.
So, Mickey Kaus, back to you. You were worried about the possibility of amnesty, the term that the professor from UCSD just used. Do you agree that he did offer something that's going to make it more difficult for the Democrats to oppose him, particularly because they don't know exactly what it is?
Well, I disagree in that he didn't mention amnesty, and I don't think he dangled the prospect of amnesty in any but the most abstract, reading his mind, wishful thinking way. It's entirely possible to have laborers for agriculture and high-tech workers without amnestying people who are here illegally. They're really two sort of separate issues. And I think it would be a disaster of him to start talking about amnesty now. The key thing that has to be done is you have to talk the Democrats off their old position, which is let's have amnesty first and worry about strengthening the borders later, and onto a position where we strengthen the borders first, and that's the price that the Democrats pay for an amnesty down the road. And you're never going to do that if you start talking about amnesty up front before the enforcement takes hold.
Samuel Popkin, we heard a contrast with Ronald Reagan earlier in 1986. Ronald Reagan went for amnesty.
Well, I don't think there's any way that the Democrats can say, do anything. The wall is going to be built metaphorically or realistically, and the current president is going to claim success for the wall. And if success is claimed for the wall, the argument about it's going to settle the argument of which we do first. He didn't say amnesty, but the minute he talks about some people staying without citizenship, you can call it anything you want, but I think if there weren't people already in the country who had been here for 10 years or 5 years or 3 years, the issue of what do we do next would be solved. Well, it would be a fight over countries and how many you let in from where. And I think everybody has always known you can't solve the problem without dealing with the people who have been here 15 years.
So where do you think the president left it?
He left it totally up in the air about what mix, but he no longer has said everybody goes. He tried this out in Austin, Texas, right before he visited Mexico for a day, and he's back to it. He's basically dangling it. We'll have some.
Okay.
It could be 100 people, it could be 20 million, but now there's going to be a bargain.
Okay, we're going to be back, continue this conversation after just a moment. We'll take a very, very, very brief break. On our talking point later, Snapchat and billions in expected investments for messages that disappear. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here, host of To The Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To The Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, and only back with To The Point, Donald Trump's first address to a joint meeting of Congress. We're talking about the style and the substance. Molly Reynolds is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She studies Congress and how congressional rules and procedure affect domestic policy and outcomes. And, of course, the president was addressing Congress about his policies. Molly Reynolds, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
He talked a lot about a vast increase in the military, 10% for the Pentagon. He talked about $1 trillion, as I think it was, in infrastructure spending. Did he indicate how those things would be financed?
So I think it's important after the speech to think about as much what he didn't say as what he did. And he didn't give a lot of indications on exactly how we're going to get from point A to point B on paying for some of these things that he wants to do. So you're correct that he has proposed a very large increase in defense spending, about $54 billion. Under current law, under the current budgetary caps imposed by the Budget Control Act, Congress would be unable to spend that much more money on defense without changing the underlying law on infrastructure spending. He did say that he's looking for $1 trillion in infrastructure investment. I think it's worth noting that that's the word he used. That's not necessarily equivalent to $1 trillion in new government spending. But he did, particularly on the infrastructure side, offer really few details about exactly what we think that might look like. He mentioned this idea of public-private partnerships. That may or may not work for all members of the Congressional Republican Party. There may be some Republican House members and senators where in their states the needs, the infrastructure needs that they have aren't ones that lend themselves easily to having a public-private financing system. So we will have to see sort of what exactly Trump proposes on both of those fronts going forward.
Defense spending is very popular with the Congress, largely because there's a defense contractor or a subcontractor in basically every congressional district, and they all are lobbied long and hard on that. On the other hand, you say there's restrictions on the budget, and as I understand it, the Democrats are saying if you lift them for the military, then you got to lift them for other things as well. But Trump wants to cut other things. What does he want to cut, and is it enough to make up for the expending he wants to do on the military and the infrastructure?
Right. So earlier this week, Trump, through his Office of Management and Budget, indicated that he was interested in spending $54 billion more in defense and then having roughly equivalent cuts on the non-defense discretionary side of the budget. We heard pretty immediately from folks in both parties that that strategy is probably not going to work very well on the Hill. From Democrats, we heard what we've been hearing from them for several years, which is that if we're going to increase defense spending, we have to see a corresponding equal-sized increase in non-defense discretionary spending. Democrats over the past several years, particularly in the Senate, have very effectively unified around that principle, and they've been able to use their procedural rights in the Senate to obstruct appropriations bills until an agreement was in place that would change spending on the defense and non-defense sides of the budget equally. And on the Republican side, we've actually also heard from several Republicans, particularly folks on the Appropriations Committees in both the House and the Senate, that at this point it's not entirely clear where we would find another $54 billion in cuts on the non-defense discretionary side of the budget. We've had reductions in a lot of those programs already, thanks to the caps put in place by the Budget Control Act. And so even Republicans are saying we're not sure where we could find those cuts that big to offset the cuts or the increases that Trump is looking for on the defense side.
And Walter Shapiro mentioned earlier that he didn't say anything about the deficit, despite the fact that it's $20 trillion. Pointed out that Ronald Reagan was worried about it when it was $1 trillion. How important do you think is that? And does all that you and I are discussing suggest that Mr. Trump has anything but an easy road dealing with Congress based on what he said last night?
So you're absolutely right, and Walter is right to mention that Trump talked very little about the debt last night. I think we are currently seeing on Capitol Hill, Republicans abandon a lot of their rhetoric that they used pretty aggressively during the Obama administration about deficits and debt. I think we're seeing some of them sort of reveal that talking about the deficit and debt when there was a Democratic president in the White House was, for them, a very convenient and easy way to oppose what a Democratic president wants to do. I think going forward, it will be challenging for Trump to get some of these things he's talked about done, in particular because on a lot of these questions of discretionary spending for defense and for non-defense programs, it requires the support of some Democratic senators. Those measures would need to clear the threat of a filibuster in the Senate, and so he's going to need to find a way to get some of those folks on board. And it's not clear to me how a plan that increases defense spending and cuts non-defense spending is going to do that.
Molly Reynolds, once again, studies Congress and how congressional rules and procedure affect policy at the Brookings Institution. You said it was important to look at the things he didn't mention as well as the things that he did. One of the things he didn't say much about at all was foreign affairs, although he did say at one point that he is supportive of NATO. But here's how he summarized his relationship to the world.
Free nations are the best vehicle for expressing the will of the people, and America respects the right of all nations to chart their own path. My job is not to represent the world. My job is to represent the United States of America.
Back to our first guest from the first part of our program, Walter Shapiro, columnist for Roll Call, professor as well as lecturer at Yale. Tell us, if you will, what do you take from that in terms of any change that Donald Trump is looking at by comparison to past presidents?
Well, first of all, I have to mention that when Trump went out of his way to praise NATO, an institution that he was not always filled with praise about, he mentioned that NATO has stood with us in two world wars. As I recall, NATO wasn't around for World War I. As I recall, if it were around for World War II, Germany would not have been a pivotal part of it. I have to say, as a former White House speechwriter, the level of fact-checking in this speech is still at a fifth-grade level. But the larger point is that we don't know what Trump's foreign policy is, that right now we seem to have a national security advisor who can't get to the Oval Office, who tried to stop the word radical Islamic terrorism from being used in the speech and failed. We have a Secretary of State who isn't invited to meetings with world leaders. And we basically have these shadowy clones of Steve Bannon running around the White House. To try to figure out what Donald Trump's foreign policy is something that I can't figure it out, and I am just think that we're all very fortunate in these first 6 weeks that the world has not presented us with a major new threat or problem.
Mickey Kaus, again, author of The End of Equity, a blogger at Kaus Files, and a supporter of Donald Trump's immigration policies. What do you say to that?
Well, I thought it was pretty clearly a repudiation of George W. Bush and his grand so-called neoconservative plans to democratize the world, and so I thought it was not substanceless. It seemed to be a return to a more realistic foreign policy where we pursue our interests, and there's definitely meat to the idea that America will represent itself not the world. I'm not necessarily saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it means something, and it means we're not going to sacrifice our own self-interest for the cause of, you know, global betterment. I don't think it's conflictless. It means he's not going to do another Iraq.
Samuel Popkin at UC San Diego, you've consulted with five Democratic presidential campaigns. Democrats, as well as George W. Bush, have talked about American leadership in the world. Do you hear Donald Trump turning away from that when he says the kind of thing we just heard from the speech last night?
Well, on country-to-country dealings as opposed to multilateral, it's clear he wants us to deal one-on-one with every country, and it's clear he doesn't want us to care about internal politics. That's what President Reagan said in respect to Carter, and George W. Bush said with respect to Clinton. No more nanny, no more worrying about these things. But then you have to do some of this to make any sense and to keep alliances, whether you want the alliances or not. And just as W. Bush had to clarify the one China when Taiwan got too frisky, this president has had to. So there's a whole set of reality-based checks on how far you can go. It's clear he wants to ignore multilateral institutions as much as he can, but it's also clear that in many cases he has no choice but to work with them, and we don't know where he's going to end up yet.
Molly,
and I want to defend him for a second. I don't think he's out of control when he says something nasty in the morning to one group and something nice in the afternoon. We all thought President Reagan was a fool when he made comments about evolution just being a theory and that he didn't know what he was doing. But in fact, those little bonbons were thrilling all the evangelicals who hadn't been voting for anybody in the past. And then he'd go and give a speech on healthcare or science, and everybody would quiet on one side and say, okay, he understands the world of science. Whereas at the same time, he'd thrilled the others. And he's got a lot of people there who don't want to hear about Jews and the Holocaust. So he mentions it later, not at the Holocaust Museum. He's keeping two constituencies happy.
So let me go back to the domestic side with Molly Reynolds. Obviously, keeping constituents happy is certainly a domestic issue, but very specifically healthcare and science. The president hasn't appointed a lot of people, and he wants to make cuts on the domestic side. People have talked about the possibility of a crisis occurring that we wouldn't be able to respond to. That might bring FEMA into the issue or the program as well. What about those kinds of entities? They're pretty important, and are they, in fact, at the moment, being underfinanced and understaffed?
Sure. So I think that you hit the nail on the head when you brought up both the financing and the staffing. And so, and I think this is one reason I mentioned earlier that there are some Republicans who have come out and pointed out that a $54 billion cut on the non-defense discretionary side of the budget would be quite difficult to implement, both politically and also because they're not quite sure where in the federal government we would find cuts of that magnitude. And I think that that reflects the point you just made about people arguing that various programs are underfinanced at this point. On the staffing, we have indeed seen the Trump administration be relatively slow in filling lots of key administration positions. We do know that in the Senate, Democrats have chosen to pursue a strategy whereby they've slow-walked a lot of the cabinet-level nominees he has put forward. But even beyond that, he's offered relatively few nominations to posts at the sub-cabinet level. And at the end of the day, those folks are the kinds of people in the federal government who keep the trains running on time. And so the longer we go without a fully staffed executive branch, the more difficult it is to make sure that the federal government is running efficiently and well.
And, of course, once again, there's the question of the Affordable Care Act. Paul Ryan, as he went out yesterday, said that the president hit a home run, and he was great on Obamacare. But is there an agreement between the president and the Congress? Is there even agreement within the Republicans in Congress about the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare and what to do about it?
I don't think there is yet. I think it's really telling that so Trump did talk briefly about health care in the speech last night. He offered a set of what I believe he referred to as principles that should guide Congress's action on the Affordable Care Act going forward. And after the speech, folks on both sort of wings of the Republican Party, so both Ryan and other Republican leaders and folks on the more conservative end of the caucus, pointed to particular things that Trump did or did not say in that healthcare section as evidence that Trump was with them, that Trump agreed with what the position they had been advancing in deliberations in recent weeks. So I think there's still important disagreements within the Republican Party, both within each chamber, within the House and the Senate, and then between the chambers about the best course to pursue from here.
So, Walter Shapiro, final question to you. As we gave you the first question, Trump tweeted today, thank you, apparently in response to all the good news that he's been hearing about his speech and the way that it has been received. How long do you think this era of good feeling is going to last?
Two more tweets. Also, the large point is that there is no evidence yet that Donald Trump can deliver on any policy issue. There is no agreement among Republicans on health care. And as even Trump said to the governors on Monday, you have to do health care before you can do tax cuts. And as people said earlier, many Republicans don't want the infrastructure spending. So we may be spending the entire year trying to figure out if our new president can get anything of significance through Congress other than housekeeping resolutions on the budget and the debt ceiling.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Walter Shapiro with Roll Call, the Brennan Center for Justice, a lecturer at Yale and author of Hustling Hitler, about his con man of an uncle. Mickey Kaus, The End of Equality, blogger at Kaus File. Samuel Popkin at UC San Diego, a book coming out, The Republican Crackup and the Future of Presidential Politics. And Molly Reynolds, a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Many thanks to you all. Great to have you on our program. In a moment, Facebook overtook Twitter. Will Snapchat overtake Facebook? Back in a moment with To the Point from Public Radio International. Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. Snap Inc., the parent of Snapchat, will make its initial public offering tomorrow, and trading will begin on the New York Stock Exchange. Even among the stratospheric finances of the tech world, we're likely talking big money. Sarah Friar is a tech reporter for Bloomberg in San Francisco. Great to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Very quickly, for those in our audience who don't know, what happens on Snapchat and who are its main customers?
So Snapchat is a communication app that allows people to communicate primarily via photos and videos that they take. You open the app, it opens right to a camera, and you capture the moment you're in, and then you can either send it to your friends or send it to your personal story, which is kind of like a reality show of your life. You can just upload things as they happen, and all your friends can follow it.
Do you have to do it in a hurry before it disappears?
Well, you don't have to snap in a hurry before it disappears, but people have to watch it, and then once they watch it, they can't get it again.
Okay, so once again, it disappears, and apparently relatively quickly. So why is it, the second part of my question was, who are the main customers for Snapchat?
So the main audience, the people who use the app, tend to be the younger set. You know, these are the millennials, Gen Z, people who are very used to Facebook and Instagram, but like Snapchat because it gives them a little bit more of a raw look at people's lives. It's not the polish that you see on those other social platforms. In terms of advertisers, the people that Snapchat makes money off of, You know, it ranges. A lot of the really big brands are advertising on Snapchat right now, like the Coca-Colas and Budweiser's of the world, who are just trying to tap into this audience that they really are having a harder time reaching on regular television as they stop paying for cable subscriptions.
A lot of kids involved in this. Interesting that Budweiser is one of the sponsors.
They weren't always. Snap recently made it possible to know if somebody was 21 or not.
Okay. So has Snap made a lot of money as yet?
So they have. They've made a little more than $400 million in 2016, which is more than a six-fold increase from their revenue the year before. However, their losses greatly eclipse their revenues. So for the next few years, what people buy into this business want to see is a great expansion of that advertising business, as well as other business models they've gotten into. I don't know if you're in LA, you maybe have seen people walk around with Snapchat spectacles. That's one of their first forays into hardware.
So what is the expected value of what's going to be offered tomorrow? And how much is it expected to expand when the trading begins?
Oh, see, these are questions that we don't have answers to yet. We know that the valuation range is going to be around $20 billion, but tonight, or I should say this afternoon if you're on the West Coast, the shares will price, and that's just dependent on how much demand there is for the stock. The bankers will decide, okay, this is the price we want to IPO at. And then tomorrow on the New York Stock Exchange, Snapchat will Snap Inc., which is the formal name of the company, will list and start trading publicly for the first time. And it could jump wildly. It could be, which is, you know, kind of what happened to Twitter. They opened up a share of trading at a much higher rate than their IPO rate. Or it could be a disappointment. With Facebook, they had their share price pretty stagnant for all of the first day of trading.
On the other hand, they have boomed since then. What is it about?
So I was just about to say, those two companies, very different IPOs, very different life as public companies. So it's very clear that the first day of trading is no indication of how the stock will do long term. Twitter's IPO is considered a success. The company is not considered to have been a successful public company. Facebook's IPO was definitely not a success. It had, you know, technical errors and lawsuits related to it, but certainly they have become extremely profitable for people to own.
Tell us a little bit more about the culture of Snap Inc. and Snapchat. You're up in San Francisco near Silicon Valley. Snap is down here in Los Angeles, in Venice. That's made them very different in a lot of ways.
It absolutely does. You know, a lot of companies up here, they have this very open culture. They have corporate campuses. They have weekly all-hands meetings where they talk about what's going on in the business. Snap has a very different structure. It's much more siloed. The company is much more secretive. As in Venice, the buildings are scattered in small portions of real estate. There's no corporate campus where everyone gathers. So that changes a lot of the way people communicate within the company. And they actually say in their filing for going public that could be a risk factor, that it could affect employee morale.
You talked about a bee colony that disappeared near a tree in Venice that had something to do with Snap.
Yes. Okay. So the bee colony was removed by Snapchat, and the neighbors immediately thought the worst. Right? They thought that, you know, these are bee killers. Signs went up that said all bee lives matter, and Snapchat, it turns out, had actually paid a biologist to safely relocate these bees. So it was an extremely humane process. But that didn't change people's minds about Snap, because this is a community, I mean, as you know, a very, very bohemian, eclectic, artistic community. And now it's sort of being turned into a corporate campus for Snap. And so everyone who you know, sees them open up new offices, take all the, what seems like all the available real estate, it's caused a lot of tension. And actually today in Venice, there has been a huge protest against Snap.
Okay, so who are going to be the instant millionaires or perhaps even billionaires if Snap catches on?
So the company is certainly going to make CEO Evan Spiegel and co-founder Bobby Murphy very rich. Evan gets an award, a hundreds of millions of dollars reward, just by having a successful IPO, just by going through the process. And so it's really going to help their employees finally cash out on these generous offers of stock they had to join, right? That stock doesn't mean anything until you have a liquidity event like the IPO and you can actually sell it and get money back. So certainly Snap's employees, there'll be many more millionaires. And that's another reason that Venice neighbors are quite worried about the future of their environment.
If they manage to ensure long-term investment and hang on to the original investors, what are they likely to do with the money?
Snap needs to greatly expand its advertising business. They've been hiring up salespeople like crazy. They need to figure out what else they want to be. So Snapchat changed its name to Snap Inc. in the fall of last year and said that, you know, they consider themselves the owners of Spectacles and Snapchat and many more things to come. So I think they're thinking about it sort of like Alphabet, the owner of Google, which there's many different divisions doing different things. So it's unlike Facebook or Twitter starting out where they just said, you know, we're a company for communication. This is a company that wants to be about more than that. They call themselves a camera company, actually.
You hear about virtual reality. That makes sense for a camera company. And
absolutely.
And virtual reality,
augmented reality, drones. They've been testing all sorts of things like beacons and location sensing technology and sensors of other types. I mean, they have a hardware lab that they've just been working on new products and a lot of prototypes. We don't know what they'll actually release. But certainly they want to sort of own capturing the moment, like the moment where you're on vacation, you see a beautiful sunset, you take a picture, you take a video. They want to be the app you use to capture that.
Okay, Sarah Friar, again, tech reporter for Bloomberg in San Francisco. You won't be able to watch this directly, but you're certainly going to be able to keep track of what happens tomorrow when Snap has its IPO. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Orin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.